Radio Decidimos.
Hola, buena tarde. Hi everyone. This is the Data Decolonialism session. We are here very happy in a debate to discuss this very interesting and very relevant topic with Anasuya Sengupta from Whose Knowledge, and with Paola Ricarte from the Tecnológico de Monterrey and from the Bergman Klein Center. I'm very happy to be here as well. This is a pleasure to be talking to them, to be here at the CIDIM Fest. So I hope that this is gonna be a very interesting and very fruitful session of debate. Hi. Hi, Anasuya, welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
How are you doing?
Doing well. It's slightly sunny in London, which is unusual, so I'm happy.
I'm very happy to meet you. On this meeting here. It's a pleasure to talk to you today.
Very much a pleasure.
Well, we can start our debate. I have prepared some questions to kickstart, and I'll be very happy as well to have plenty of questions from our audience here. And at first, to start debating a bit about like how to challenge power, how to deal with oppression, to deal with violence towards a radical democracy, right? Towards like using situated knowledge to center these different knowledges that come from the margins. So I'd like to start asking you if you could tell us about your own personal process of embodied resistance against this data coloniality and against knowledge injustice. And how have you been living that? And how has that affected or impacted your community in this process? So like really bringing it to your own personal experience at first.
Thank you so much for having me and for having Paola here.
Hi, because, Paola.
Because we are all friends that seem to continue our friendship through being on panels together, which is amusing. And I suppose that's one version of feminist friendship and of epistemic friendship. I think in terms of personal practice, I'm really glad you asked that question, and I'm glad you asked that question first, because for all that we do as Whose Knowledge, we really root ourselves in practice, because no matter what words we use, what theoretical frames we have, where we are located, and situated in multiple positions of power and privilege, or dispower and disprivilege, ultimately it is about practice. It is about what we do and how we inhabit the world in relationship to ourselves, to each other, and to the many forms of sentience around us. And so in terms of practice, I think it's about always starting with the questions of power, of recognizing context, and in different contexts, asking oneself, and we like to call it an intersection of radical honesty and radical love, asking the tough questions of who holds the power here, and in what ways, and who doesn't hold power, and in what ways. Because of course, power is deeply complex, it's dynamic, it's not a static thing. It's about identity, it's about issue, it's about systems of knowledge, it's about economics, it's of course about political power. There are many different forms that all interlock and intersect in different ways. So for us at Whose Knowledge, and for me personally, one of the ways I approach this is to be very honest about the fact that I myself embody different positions of power and privilege, and dispower and disprivilege. As someone who is a brown woman from India, from the global south, challenging and critiquing the tech sector and philanthropy at different areas of power. I'm often one of the few people in the room who looks like me or who says the things I do. At the same time, if I'm in India, I have immense power and privilege in different ways. I am middle class. I have an education that is English-led. And most importantly, I'm Savarna, which means I'm from the so-called upper caste of India, of a caste system that is one of the most oppressive social systems in the world. And so I myself have to recognize that I embody these different positions of power. And that is how I approach the work that I do.
Okay. That's very interesting. Hi, Paola, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm fine, thank you. Super happy to be here and also to share the panel with Anne and Suya.
I'm glad to have you in this conversation as well. We were talking a little bit about very personal experience, right, of resisting and moving forward in bringing situated knowledge from the margins to the center. So what about you? Tell us a little bit about your personal experience in this process as well, starting like from this very embodied experience. How has that been for you in academia, outside of academia?
Well, I think I totally agree with Anasuya, as you can imagine. I think that the process of epistemic resistance it's a process first, and then it's a practice. So it's not about a theoretical framework or an ideal or an idea that just stays there somewhere. So it's something that is not easy, because as Anasuya said, it's a problem of how to recognize our own positionality and the whole entanglement of power. And also, I think it's different for every political community and person, because we have a common goal. We have this common goal of eradicating domination and violence and dispossession. But the ways that we engage in that struggle is different. So one of our challenges, I think, as feminists, and especially as decolonial feminists, is trying not to delegitimize the processes that others try to achieve and do to make sense of their own political practice. So in my case, I would say I'm trying to do everything I can to contribute to this struggle to achieve autonomy and a dignified life, not only for me, but also for the communities that always have been marginalized and excluded from everything. So again, it's not a theory, it's not only a framework, it's a practice. So it's hard. It's hard because you always have contradictions. You always are trying to be self-reflective of your own ways of embodying these structural violences. So I think that small actions and seeing this struggle as a path that we are walking together is what makes me understand that this process is not, of course, personal, but connected.
Okay, that's very interesting. I imagine we can ask questions for the audience as well. So can we try to get questions? Does anyone want to ask any specific question to Paola or to Anasuya? Or I can keep on shooting questions as well. Well, we have Nadia over there.
Nadia, and thank you so much for being with us here today. I'm such a fan of Who's Knowledge, and so glad to be able to see you sort of live in person. But I guess in terms of when we talk about practice, I was wondering, my question is about developing good governance practice for Who's Knowledge, because I mean there's so much research done on, for example, the misogyny in Wikipedia and the uneven power dynamics. And I was wondering if within the project that there were guiding principles or good practices for more, I guess, egalitarian, I don't even know if that's the correct word, stakeholder relations or ways to navigate these online collaborations and to even create processes that you can more or less use to regulate the governance of the project itself. Sorry if that was long-winded, but yeah, and just in terms of good governance practices and what does that look like, or what does it look like working on it?
Thank you so much.
Nadia, thank you for that question. That's such an excellent question, and it's such a good question of practice. And as Paola said, practice is always uneasy and difficult because it's always about power. And that's true for governance. I think that's where I'd start. I'd start with recognizing that governance, simply as a form of bureaucratic or legal accountability, is a very low bar, right? That for us to think about radical governance, it is about thinking about how we are accountable to our communities, to who we serve and how we serve them. And then how does that reflect back in the structures that we create, that we talk of as governance? You talked about Wikipedia, of course, and as you know, and others may not, but I'm a tough love Wikipedian. I love being a Wikipedian, but I do offer the movement my tough love. And one of the places I offer that tough love is in governance. And one of the things to remember and I think I said this in my address to Desiderm Fest and all of you, is that Wikipedia is seen as a participatory democracy. And participation is a low bar as well, because we assume that participation means equality or equity, and it doesn't. Jo Freeman, who is this wonderful feminist from the 70s, has a lovely piece called "The Tyranny of Structurelessness," which Paola is nodding at because it must be one of her favorites as well. And in that, Jo reminds us that even in what seems like a circle, we have differential power. And Wikipedia is similar. To assume that anybody can edit is to assume that everybody has equal access, has equal ability, has equal accessibility, and has the same frame of knowledge and argumentation that is required of a Wikipedia editor. None of those is true in our world. And so we ask the Wikimedia movement to think about governance as something that is much more nuanced, and ways to be accountable to their many communities across the world in ways that are more bottom up. And I hesitate to use that loosely, because we say bottom up very easily. And I want to problematize that as well, that governance is often an uneasy mix of the top down and the bottom up. And the only way it makes sense is in practice. And so what we ask the Wikimedia movement, for instance, is how do we make sure that structures of governance, whether online or in the organizing movement, are reflecting not only the differences in content, because most of Wikipedia is written about a very small slice of the world, and not only of contributors, because only 1 in 10 Wikipedia editors is women or non-binary folks, and only 20% of all knowledge on Wikipedia is on or by the Global South. But we're pushing them to think about different forms of knowledge, of epistemic injustice, of whose knowledge is reified and whose knowledge is made invisible, undermined, or completely ignored. And that is a much more difficult form of governance and of accountability. For whose knowledge, we turn that on ourselves. And one of the ways that we think about the ways we govern ourselves is to make sure that everything we do is in an ongoing conversation with our many communities, and that at all times we're accountable to small groups of advisors, as well as much larger conversations with our communities that give us a sense of what our strategy should be. So a lot of what we have done in the last 5 years, for instance, has come out of a conversation we had in 2018 in our first Decolonizing the Internet meeting, conference, which laid the agenda for what our community said, this is what we want you to do. And that is the way that we continue to work. So I'll stop there just to give you a glimpse of some of those issues.
Thank you very much, Anasuya. I'd like to ask a question to Paula. So there is a huge problem when it comes to even producing knowledge on race, sexuality, ethnicity, related inequalities in Europe specifically. We have a problem of like not being able to even produce that knowledge. It's a problem in the legislation in that case, right, with GDPR, and as well in the case of Spain, in the national legislation. So I was wondering, how can we tackle these issues in a scenario towards reparation and justice when we don't even, I mean, when it's really hard to even try to understand what exactly is going on there, right? Because you talked very interestingly in your presentation about like data extractivism, and it's kind of like the other way around, like using those that data to actually explore, expropriate, etc. And how can we try to turn that around towards resistance, right? To try basically to understand what's going on, so we can present more radical practices towards resistance and reparation.
Well, thank you very much for this question. I would like to begin saying, well, going a little bit forward from what Anasui was saying, because whose knowledge is reified is a fundamental question. And also we have to think about the implications of that knowledge being reified for those communities who are not like acknowledged as knowledge producers. So one of the things I'm trying to like understand is the way that with this new digital economy, the same patterns of exclusion that were used to dominate and organize the world around one race and one type of knowledge are again used to continue that process of domination and exclusion and dispossession of people and territories that were previously colonized. So when we speak about reparation and what to do to like try to eliminate or or struggle against this system that continues eliminating knowledges and people from the face of the earth, because as Mbembe says, it's not only a process of epistemic exclusion or epistemic justice, it's a problem of eliminating certain bodies because they are not acknowledged as human beings, or they are not acknowledged as bodies that matter. So when we understand the consequences of this epistemic injustice, and how this epistemic injustice is a process, is a rationality that is necessary, that is used to legitimize the domination of some groups over others, then we can also try to understand how can we try to build different ways of recovering our autonomy and dignity together, of course. This process, as we were saying before, this process is not easy. As we were saying, because it implies a lot of things that we are not used to, and that speak directly to power structure. So even when we are trying to, as communities or collectives, trying to build these alternative ways of relating to each other, to live in the world free of violence and domination, is not so easy. But what gives me hope is that I have been seeing, like, in many places around the world, and of course in Latin America and Africa and all the countries that have been excluded from the conversation in general, that people are doing things, that people are trying to resist in many ways, in every dimension they can, in terms of trying to gain technological autonomy, to gain data autonomy, to try to construct or build new governance models of organizations, but also data relations, infrastructures. So I think there are many, many, many examples around the world of people trying to resist and also to repair the way that the world has been constructed to diminish and exclude people from the conversation.
Thank you so much. Do we have more questions from the audience? I can keep on asking more questions as well. I was thinking, when we think about the life cycle of data, when we try to reimagine visualization of data and how we can try to do that, basically from a different perspective, from different kind of references, how could we try to do that, basically, from references from the Global South? I was trying to think as well and see if we can debate a bit about how we can rethink, reimagine visualization of data. I think we might have had a little disconnection.
I think we're both on. I think we're wondering who you're asking the question to.
Okay, fair enough. To you, Vanasuya, what do you think, how could we try to rethink the visualization of data from different, from basically different references, to try to reconceptualize how we can visualize, how we can use different ways, either artistic or body visualizations. I don't know if you have come across, let's say, decolonizing or like different ways from the margins to visualize data that could connect with different communities from different forms of knowledge.
I think for me, the question has to go back a little further, because visualization is just one form. I think it has to go back to whose data is it, whose imagination is at the core of that data collection, who is governing it. Is it a sovereign data set, right? And then from there, there are many epistemic frames of how you can express that data. Just as an example that I've been thinking about recently, because it is something that I myself find so difficult and at the same time so extraordinary to try and understand, or to grok, as we say in the tech sector, is the Aboriginal or Indigenous Australian way of understanding the world, or Jukurpa. The colonial anthropologists and then the rest of us have called it dream time or dreaming, and make all sorts of claims about it, which are, of course, not the claims that Indigenous Australians would make. But we call it Aboriginal art, right? And many of you may know what this is. If you're on mobile devices right now, you could look up what Aboriginal art says. And that's a form of visualization, right? That's the way we understand visualization. And yet, in the tradition of Jukurpa, Jukurpa is a philosophy, it's a religion, it's a way of understanding reality. And we can't even get our heads around it, because the process of colonization and our own ways of embodying that colonization, we as Black and brown people also are colonized, right? And in turn, we colonize. Because it, as Paola put so beautifully, it's our bodies that are seen as not differentially important, but also our minds and our imaginations. And so I think the question around visualization to me has to start again with, are we questioning the knowledge frame itself, the ways that we inhabit the world, and how that form of habitation and the expression of that habitation is very different from what we have been taught as 18th century enlightenment, right? And similarly with maps. I love maps, and yet every time I look at a map, I recognize what a colonial instrument it is. The way that the Pacific Islanders understood map is very different, right? The way they visualized maps, or the ways, or not maps so much as the ways they understood how to navigate the oceans, is very different. It's multidimensional. And so I would ask ourselves, even in the word visualization, to maybe ask the question, how do we express our ways of knowing, being, and doing in the world?
Thank you so much. That was very interesting. And to Paola, I would like to ask about more examples of counter-hegemonic data governance models. We were talking a bit about data governance. Both Anasuya and Paola talked about that with us in their answers before. So I would like to know a bit more, like perhaps more examples, more collectives, and what kind of practices they are engaging in to counter resist for data governance.
Well, Anasi was mentioning New Zealand, and there is a very interesting project there called Paparigo. It's a natural language processing tool in Maori, but also the community, the Maori community, the group that is working with this tool, they have developed their own license with the values of the community. So they have like set the criteria of how the data are going to be used, by whom. This is, of course, a collection of their own data, their own data collection. And I think that's an amazing process about how a community defines the rules and the knowledge that they want to produce, that they want to share with the world according their own needs and of course their own values. So I think that there's a very interesting movement around the world among indigenous communities from around the world in general. They have developed data standards, of course, alternative principles. And in every region in Africa and Latin America, there are also many examples of communities building projects that show the way to other forms of data governance and tech governance. And I think that, well, in general, these projects tend to be community-based and small because they require not only technical effort, but also political effort, as I was saying, to solve these tensions about governance and how to develop different ways of inhabiting these processes. And of course, these community-based governance models require a greater commitment from the communities. In Mexico, there are many examples. There is a tech cooperative called Tierra Común. Many people here, well, Yama is there, and also Tred is there. There is also a hackerspace called Racho Electronico. There is an indigenous association called Red C. They develop indigenous telecommunications networks. In Colombia, for example, there is a community of practice called Grafoscopio. There is Maria Lab in Brazil. Many examples. There is a tech cooperative, a free software tech cooperative in Argentina. So I think there are many projects that show the strength of organized communities, and that also show like the complexity of building these projects in terms of sustainability, because they are making a choice for autonomy. So they are usually at the margins of the industry, of the state. And that path, as I said, it's a hard path and a hard path to follow. But at the same time, these examples for me are examples that show us the way that we could address these different models of being in the world, these different models of the world.
That's very interesting. I'll ask a final question. We're coming to the end of our awesome debate. I'll ask to Anasuya now. What would you recommend for communities that are about to start or that want to start their own processes of mapping and centering their knowledges? Like the first thing to think, or a couple of things to think, if they are organizing and putting that into their agenda and trying to make that happen, what would you recommend from your experience, from your situated knowledge, from what you have seen in your communities?
Well, I think one of the things that is really interesting about this process is to recognize that it includes both individual effort and collective energy, right? That it just like, you know, Paula and I are not debating because we actually build on each other, because we actually agree with each other. So, you know, unlike the usual sort of version of the world where we might be debating each other and confronting, we actually have built together, even in this conversation with you, Terrine. So just that sense of recognizing that so much of knowledge production, at least from the margins. And when we say from the margins, again, I think both Paula and I would probably like to remind all of us that the margins are the minoritized majority of the world. we are the majority of the world. We are at the so-called margins simply because in the ways that power and privilege function, we feel as though we are marginalized, we are minoritized. And yet as women, as Indigenous folks, as Black and Brown folks, as folks from the Global South, we are the majority. So it's sometimes useful to remember that, because even as we talk about centering from the margins, and Bell Hooks did this so beautifully in her book, the margins are actually central. We are not the periphery in terms of numbers. So as Whose Knowledge, the way that we have done it is to work really deeply and respectfully with different communities to support the ways in which they think about what of their knowledges they want to see shared with the rest of the world. Not all knowledges are meant to be shared. And I think we have to be very conscious of that, especially as those of us who are in the tech world and who are in the radical tech world, we tend to think of open knowledge, right? We tend to think of free and open source as the way to go. And in many ways, that is true. And yet, what is open must be defined, self-defined by community. And it can only be open when it is safe and welcoming for everyone. And so the knowledge that folks want to share, that communities want to share, we ask them to think about them, that themselves. Then we ask them, how would they like to express it? How would they like to express this knowledge? Where would they like to express it, right? So for instance, in our case, with one of our communities, the Dalit feminist communities, they wanted to work on Wikipedia because Wikipedia has been so problematic around caste. Another community that is the queer community from Sarajevo, Bosnia, wanted to create an archive, an oral archive of testimonies of LGBTQI activists during the Bosnian War. And a third community we worked with, which is the Native American Kumeyaay Nation from Southern California and Baja, Mexico. They cross borders, of course. The Kumeyaay did not want to come online because they were concerned about how much their knowledge has been exploited, co-opted, and commercialized. And so for them, the ways that they talked about sharing their knowledge was to share within the community and across generations. And so again, I think so much of doing this work has to start with the communities themselves, recognizing that communities are also not monolithic, romantic notions, right? Communities are themselves have different ways of navigating power and privilege within themselves. But asking those that are scholars and activists to self-define the terms of reference with which they want to share their knowledges and the forms in which they want to share them. And if it's helpful, we wrote a collaborative set of resources called Our Stories, Our Knowledges, that talks about some of the ways in which we did this work. And I can share that by the link if it's helpful.
Thank you so much. Thank you everyone for this session. It has been a pleasure talking to Anasuya, talking to Paola. I learned a lot. I hope this was as well as fruitful for you. And now we're going to keep on with the Sitting Fast next session that's going to come in approximately 10 minutes on rough justice. So we're going to see you soon. Bye-bye. Thank you so much.
Gracias. And gracias, Paola.
Gracias.